I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Dr. Samuel Meir. Recent research is suggesting that a native language can actually impact on musical ability. The research compared the melodic and rhythmic abilities of nearly 500,000 people across 54 different languages. Dr. Samuel Meir is the study's lead author and head of the Music Lab, which is a collaboration between Auckland Uni and Yale University. And it's really neat to have him on the program. Samuel, tēnā koe. My name's Dale, and I appreciate spending some time with you, Eho. Tēnā koe.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's really neat to delve into this area. So you run Music Lab, which looks at music in ways most of us wouldn't. We either like or dislike the sound that we're hearing. And to be honest, Sam, I never gave much thought to how native language or an ability with it can impact musical ability. But that's the focus of our kaupapa initially. What intrigues you about the connection?
Well, in our lab, we study a lot of questions about why human minds hear music the way that we do hear music. And one of the big questions that we've been looking at over the last 5-10 years or so is what's similar across people and across cultures in music. So the fact that many different societies produce music in similar ways, we all sing lullabies to our babies, we all dance, and so on. But in this study, we're interested in what's different about different people listening to music around the world. We were sort of surprised to find that despite the fact that everybody makes music in similar ways worldwide, there are some fairly clear differences across different groups here.
I've been a little fascinated too. I've always had a love of music. Most of our Māori people have too, Sam. I'm not saying that you don't too, mate, but it features strongly. And I've been a little hoo-ha over the years because musoethnologists have suggested that we were pre-European and unmelodic people, which to me seemed a little strange, seeing as we love to sing and harmonise now. But our pre-European waiata were very much... almost mirrored the waves and lacked melody. Have you delved into this? Is there any reality to that, or did we falsetto it with the rest of the world up and down the scales as is familiar to us now?
I would say that anyone saying that pre-colonial Maori were not producing music would be completely wrong. I think there's very little evidence for that. And what we find in a lot of our cross-cultural studies is that really the universals that turn up across every society around the world are quite clear. There's music everywhere. Everyone comes into the world prepared to hear music and to produce music themselves. And there are some very clear similarities in how they do that. So, for example, you know, I don't actually know any lullabies in Te Reo myself, but I can tell you without even having heard them that there are some clear similarities that are likely to be found. For example, lullabies are almost always worldwide slower than other songs, which makes sense because they're calming, they're for soothing babies and putting people to sleep. I think that the evidence that we have from more modern science shows that really everywhere in the world we find lots and lots of music in similar ways.
Thanks, Sam. I don't understand these terms. Perhaps our listeners would be in the same position to describe the difference between a tonal and a non-tonal language. So how does speaking a tonal versus a non-tonal language impact people's musical ability?
Well, so what we find in the study is that across a couple different classes of languages, we see some fairly fine-grained differences in how people understand the music that they hear. So in tonal languages like Mandarin or Cantonese or Yoruba in East Africa, this is the type of language where the pitch that you use when you say a particular syllable or word actually changes the meaning of the word. So one of the examples of this is the syllable ma in Mandarin can mean a few different things. It can mean mother, horse, gold, and a few other meanings, depending on how you say it, if the pitch is rising or falling. And that's not the case for languages like English or Te Reo Māori, where the pitch that you use does convey information. You know, it sends a signal about, you know, how excited you are when you're speaking or what your tone of voice is meaning, but it doesn't change the meaning of the word itself. So what we find is that people who speak tonal languages like Mandarin or Cantonese, they have fairly improved melodic discrimination. They hear the tones and melodies a little bit more precisely than other people do, but they also have a disadvantage with hearing how the beat lines up with a piece of music that they're listening to.
When I listen to Chinese music on a single stringed instrument, I know that it doesn't sit real well with what has been a colonized musical mind. Counting the beat, for instance, regimental marching, etc. There are many musical styles, and sometimes our exposure to Western musical norms perhaps can cloud our appreciation of other ways of conveying sounds musically.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a very clear effect of globalization on the types of music that people are just likely to hear. So, for example, in my field, when we want to study the diversity of listeners' experiences around the world, it's very important that we don't only study people who are connected to the internet and who might be hearing the same stuff you can get on YouTube to one another. So for that reason, we in addition to doing these web-based studies like the one that we're talking about today, we also do studies where we collaborate with anthropologists who go out into the field and they reach societies that are not connected to the internet and that do not have radio, so that we can study what the perceptual abilities are of these different people. And we actually have another paper that's coming out probably in a month or two, looking at music perception abilities in a more wider array of listeners. One of the things I would say about this paper, though, is that even though all the people in the study are connected to the internet and share some of that globalized musical culture, we do see pretty clear differences between how people hear music. So even though, you know, our Mandarin listeners in Beijing also can get on YouTube just like our, you know, New Zealanders here, we see quite a bit of difference between the language experience of those listeners and their music perception abilities.
I'm interested in, we're on a Māori radio station too, of the mita or the rhythmic patterns delivered in language and how that might influence or affect our appreciation of music per se. Can you give us some thinking around that?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. We haven't actually studied it in this paper, and that's a quite a good area for future research, I think, on this topic, because, you know, one way that languages differ, as we've studied here, is in how they use tones. But like you say, another one is how rhythms differ. So, for example, my father is French. And in French, you have a syllabic pattern where there's often an emphasis on the second syllable. So whereas in English, we would say ping pong, in French, you would say ping pong, and, you know, which sounds a bit funny in English to native English speakers. But we don't actually know yet what the effects are of hearing different rhythmic stresses in language experience on music processing. I think there's been very few studies of that. So it would be a really cool thing to have a look at next.
You might have already touched on this, but if not, maybe you could just flesh it out a bit. So can you give us some examples of the languages using pitch and sound patterns and how this translates to tonal and non-tonal descriptions? Did we cover that off on your example, perhaps, of the use of the term ma?
Yeah, so ma is sort of the canonical example in Mandarin, but there's actually quite a few languages, and one of the new aspects of this study is because it's such a large study done with these gamified citizen science methods, we're able to study a large number of tonal languages, not just languages from East Asia. So the ones that are typically studied in this field are Mandarin, Cantonese, Vietnamese, but there's also quite a few other tonal languages that are not from East Asia, like the Yoruba language, Zulu, Igbo, Lao. There are quite a few examples of these tonal languages. They're not the most common languages in the world. So, you know, whereas we've studied 54 languages in this paper, only about 20 of them are tonal languages. They are actually much more distributed than just studying, you know, East Asian participants.
Not all Māori can speak Te Reo Māori, Sam, but it seems, if you go by the adage, every Māori can sing. How can that be?
Well, I do think there are aspects of music that are almost more universal in a sense than some of our linguistic abilities. And to me, that's one of the really exciting things about studying the psychology of music. You know, there is an aspect of mutual intelligibility of music across cultures. You know, I am a very, very beginner Te Reo Māori speaker, but I can still hear songs in Tadeo and enjoy them and appreciate them and actually make some reliable intuitions about what's going on in those songs. And the same is true across all human languages.
It's a fascinating area, and it's very important to understand how the human mind creates and perceives music, isn't it? And I guess it must be quite a difficult soap opera to test. How are you going about that?
Well, I think one of the things that's really exciting here is that because we're doing research in 2023, where there's a lot of online tools for getting participants from all over the world to get excited about a particular topic, there's a lot of new work that's going on there that my lab is interested in. We're really into methods of citizen science. And that's how this massive sample of participants, 500,000 people in this paper, were able to participate. So we package up these music tests in a little online game. And it's a game that everybody can understand. Everybody can play it on their phone or on their computer. The website is themusiclab.org. And we're building on quite a few other citizen science projects that have been out there. So, for example, one that's quite important here in Aotearoa is the Great Kereru Count. So one of my favorite native birds is the Kereru, and there's a wonderful citizen science project where on your phone you get a little app to take pictures of the birds, to count them in your neighborhood. And the tools that we're using to study music are kind of similar in that it turns everyone into a scientist who's contributing to the work.
Well, it's been a fascinating kōrero, and I thank you for it. We're going to play this little piece of music for you, and I'd anticipate some sort of physiological or emotional reaction to its strains. Rangi, can you whack out that farewell music that we use each and every day on our program? And I'll get some responses from Sam. What does this do to you, Sam?
Well, it's good to me. I can barely hear it on my phone, though.
Okay, crank it up there, Lucky. Yeah, well, music ties us together, mate. Doesn't matter where you come from. There's something about
Absolutely.
It. And it's a wonderful tool. Could bring peace to the world if we utilised it well. Hey, Sam, I really appreciate your kōrero and the mahi that you're doing. It's really interesting, and thanks for sharing some aspects of that work. If you'd like to
thanks
know more,
so much,
go to the Music Lab, and there's a nice piece about Sam where he introduces himself. Been a lovely privilege and pleasure to have a kōrero with you, mate. Thanks very much, Sam.
Kia ora, dear.
Tēnā koe.